Okay, Gov, I'll just mention that, and then we'll start. Last week, we finished up with Rabbi Avraham Shapiro, the Rosh Hashiva Merkas Harav, the Chief Rabbi of Israel. I have a few more comments to say about what we spoke about last week. We did not start anything new last week. Today, we will be starting with Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Chazan. We'll do that in about 10 minutes, because I want to do some introduction first. I will say also, for those coming on, Torah in Motion has now instituted a new policy, although it hasn't been reflected on the website as far as I can see yet, that all previous talks are now only 99 cents. If that's 99 cents Canadian, that's even less than 99 cents for the Americans listening. So that's really a bargain. I would encourage everyone to take advantage of that. I mentioned last class that there's a lot of things I still want to get to, comments and things that people sent me, so let me spend just a couple minutes on that, and then I want to respond to an email, actually more than one, with regard to last week's class, and then we will start with Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Chazan. I want to call your attention first to this book, the memorial volume on Meir Amsel, the editor of the journal HaMa'or. Lots of interesting things in here, but relevant to our classes on Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. In the back, he has a letter from a big Rav in Bnei Brak named Saraya Dablitsky, who you get a sense of how controversial Rabbi Moshe Feinstein's tshuvot were when they first came out. It's on page 343, 344, he talks about how we have to stand up against Rav Moshe, all these crazy new psukim of his. So I think that's interesting. It says something about the time. I mentioned last class, some of you found it interesting, the psak I told you about from the Eda Haredit rabbi about women on pregnant women not fasting on Yom Kippur. I found also from the same rabbi, Rabbi Fisher. He writes that pregnant women are not allowed to fast on Tisha B'Av. Not just like other that maybe they shouldn't. They're not allowed to fast on Tisha B'Av, which I think is interesting. If you want to see other psukim on fasting, you find them on this book, Rabbi Nachum Rabinovich's Siach Nachum. He writes, says, first of all, technically, and we spoke about this when I dealt with this Brisker idea that you don't have to do any of the fast today. That was the Brisker idea, and we dealt with that in detail, so I'm not going to go through that again. But he says that technically, even Tisha B'Av, if you're a sick person, she'ein bo sakana, that you're not really deathly ill or anything, you don't have to fast. But he says that the practice is to fast. But then he says that anyone who's pregnant or nursing has the status of someone who is a sick person who not deathly ill, but if she feels like it's a problem, she shouldn't fast. And then he says, I think this is a bit of a chidush, that anyone who is nursing, any woman who's nursing, should not fast on Tisha B'Av. Not just that it's a good idea, maybe not to. A blanket rule, she should not. That, I thought, is unusual psak. Couple more things. I was asked about Eldad Hadani. This gets back to what I mentioned last class about the Ethiopian Jewish situation. Some people want to know more about Eldad Hadani. Eldad was this man who appears on the scene in the days of the Gaonim with all sorts of interesting views, unusual halachot. And some of the Gaonim took this seriously and recorded this as a different tradition. He claimed to have been from the tribe of Dan, who with some other tribes was exiled to the land of Ethiopia. And he told a whole story. In fact, I'm not going to spend the time reading it now, but one of the stories he told was about the Sambation, that in his land, the waterless river continuously bubbles with stones and dirt 6 days a week. Only on Shabbat does it rest. On Erev Shabbat, a cloud settles on its surface, preventing anyone from approaching, although it has stopped boiling. And he goes on telling more stories about the Jews of Ethiopia, their kingdom, and he claimed to be from Dan. So from there developed the idea that the Ethiopian Jews are descended from the tribe of Dan, something which the Ethiopian Jews themselves never claimed. So, you know, that we're going to take someone like this, he's an Eldad Hadani, who might have been an Ethiopian Jew. Others think maybe he was a Karaite, or there's all sorts of theories, but to say that the Radbaz, just who's quoting Eldad Hadani, like Rav Avram Shapiro, said that that's automatically authoritative. I think Ramosha Feinstein is more on the mark when he says that maybe the Radbaz didn't have all his facts. I don't know how anyone today could take Eldad Hadani seriously for anything. He obviously was a person telling stories, all sorts of stories. A couple more points. Professor Sperber, this is for you, if Mr. Judah, if you're on. He studied in the Hebron Yeshiva from the years 59 to 62. That's what you wanted me to clarify. Bamba? I was wrong. The dispute about the blessings were not Mizonos. It was that Rav David Yosef has a letter from his father, Rav Avadia, saying you make shahakal on it. And Rav Yitzhak Yosef quotes his father as saying you say Hadam on it. One more point. I mentioned this book. And I think it's, let me call your attention to things that we've dealt with. This is the book, The Customs of Lithuanian Jewry, by Rabbi Polyakov. We've spoken about Parsha Zachar and how the practice developed, that women come to listen to Parsha Zachar. He writes that, and not only Parsha Zachar, that we repeat it. We say Zecher and Zecher. Rabbi Polyakov writes, despite the suggestion of the Mishnah Berurah to repeat the word Zecher to accommodate the opinion that the reading of Zecher in the Telshe Shiva or anywhere else in Lithuania, they did not repeat it. In fact, according to former Talmidim, they did not observe this custom even in Radin, where the Chafetz Chaim had his yeshiva. This is an interesting point. Radin, where the Chafetz Chaim was, even in the Radin yeshiva, there are many things that the Mishnah Berurah writes about in the Mishnah Berurah that in the city of Radin, and where the Chafetz Chaim was not the Rav, and in the yeshiva, they did not even follow this. The idea that now we repeat Zecher, Zecher, it's pretty much universal in the Ashkenazic world for the last, I guess, 50 or 60 years. It comes about precisely because of the popularity of the Mishnah Berurah. You don't find this in the Aruch HaShulchan. As long as you had what they call a mimetic tradition, that is, you followed what your parents did and you followed the community tradition, this practice could never have developed. In Kovno, they've been reading the Megillah for 300-400 years. No one's going to come up and all of a sudden say that we have to read it separately. But with the breakdown of tradition, the transference of Jewish centers to the land of Israel, to America, you have the opportunity to develop new customs. No one said Yiskadel in Europe. It was unheard of. And now when you go into the yeshivas, I think all the Litvashi yeshivas, everyone's saying Yiskadel. That's an example of the influence of the Chafetz Chaim. Rabbi Polyakov points out also that tzitzis, wearing tzitzis out, the Mishnah Berurah says you should wear tzitzis out, and he says, quote, no one in Lithuania wore his tzitzis hanging out as people do today, not even the Rabbani, not even in Radin. And we have, you don't need him to tell us this, we have independent testimony of Talmidim, who's one Talmud from the former Radin Yeshiva, who testifies that even in the Radin Yeshiva, no one wore their tzitzis out. And by the way, that applied, I heard from one of my Rabbein from the Mir Yeshiva. It was unheard of. I don't know today if you go to the yeshiva world, what they do. I mean, I know many do, but I don't know if it's you're told you're supposed to. But the Mishnah Berurah does say you do. Okay. Now, with that, I end the introduction. I just want to make one more, pick up on one more point, because a number of you emailed me about this, and that is the notion I spoke about last week, the sense of the faithful. And I want to spend just a few minutes on this, because I think it's an important point. And a number of you want me to speak about it. And then after that, spend a few minutes on it. We'll move on to Rishro Moshe Chazan. Now, it would take really a whole lecture, a whole article, to develop the idea of sense of the faithful, certainly my thoughts of it. But let me just give you some, I don't know, talking points, if you could say. Which we spoke about last week. Why do we get into it? We got into it because of what I quoted from Rav Avram Shapiro, quoting Rav Yitzchak Miponovich. It appears in this book, Sefer Zikaron, by Rabbi Yehuda Leib Graubart. Now, I mentioned Rabbi Yehuda Leib Graubart. Let me show you his picture here. This is his picture. Yeah, there is a picture of Yehuda Leib Graubart. I can have a pointer here, I believe. Now, I'm trying to get the pointer here to work. There he is. There's Rabbi Yehuda Leib Graubart. He was a rabbi in Lithuania, Mizrahi Rav, a great Talmud Chacham with a wide-ranging education. He was involved in Russian Jewry and organizing the Orthodox. He then comes to Toronto. Let me show you. There's a full screen picture of him with his family. I don't know if he still has children. Actually, I didn't click on it properly. Hold on. Oh, yeah, you saw that. Here's a, let me show you a picture of his grave, his tombstone. This is in Toronto. He becomes rabbi of the Polish community of Toronto, which is interesting because he himself has a lot of negative things to say in this book about what happened to Polish Jewry. He really blames it on the Hasidim, or not so much the Hasidim, but the courts of the Hasidim. But in discussing the idea that the people wanted there to be a redistribution of land, we wouldn't know, by the way, what this is referring to without Rav Avraham Shapiro. He just speaks in this book here, Graubart, about the program that created disputes. And Rav Itzla gets up and then says that even though the Gedolim disagree, Kol Yisrael hu gavoh v'nala migdolei Torah, the people of Israel are more important than the Gedolim. Yisraelim inam nevim b'nei nevim heim. If the people of Israel are not prophets, they're sons of prophets. It's Rav Avraham Shapiro who tells us that the issue Graubart's discussing there in Rav Itzla is the redistribution of land. Now, Rav Avraham Shapiro had a close connection to Rav Itzla. In 1948, I think it was, he published the responsa of Rav Itzla in Ponevezh. So he had this connection, and he knew his biography very well. That's how he got into the idea of the sense of the faithful. So what does that mean, the sense of the faithful? That the rabbis say one thing, and we listen to the people over the rabbis, and I told you that this is also a Catholic notion. Well, the Talmud says, for example, well, it says what he just quoted, if the children of Israel are not prophets or sons of prophets, it also says, go out and see what the people are doing. If you're not sure what the halacha is, go see what the people are doing. Because there's a sense that the people, they carry the tradition. Kol hamon kikol shaddai. There's another expression, that the voice of the people is the voice of God. And we have examples of this, amazing examples. Do you know that in Brisk there was an Erev? Rav Chaim Soloveitchik becomes Rav of Brisk and tries to shut the Erev down, and the people say to them, no going, Rav Chaim, we don't listen to you in this, because we know that you can have Erevin. Can you imagine today a community just rejecting the Rav, saying we're not going to listen to you? The faithful in Brisk, they looked around, they saw that there are Erevin in other cities, and they say, we don't accept it. I'll give you other examples. I think everyone in America, at least Paskin Salacha, and many times by Rav Herschel Schechter, every pulpit rabbi in America, it seems, is asking him shaylas. And yet, when he says things that I guess you could say are way out there, you know, you can't drink milk, or because the people, or he has some other psukim, the people simply don't accept it. People don't accept his view on brain death. If you go to that website, the Halachic Organ Donor Society, and we had discussion of it last week, I know that Mr. Judah pointed out that it also has a check there. You can get the card where it says irreversible cessation of heartbeat, but look, you can't do any transplants with that. The whole point of the website is to prove that you can have brain death. So I just think they put in Alan Schwartz's picture there to show you there is an option. All the people there who are on this site, they seem to ask Rav Schechter questions on all sorts of other matters, but in this area, their sense tells them intuitively that this is not the right position. We don't have time now to get into the idea of consistency in following Psak. It's an issue. What does that mean to be consistent? How is it that people, you ask Rav Schechter or another Rav one thing, but another thing you don't ask him? All I'll say is that I've never heard anyone claim, even though there is a concept of Aseh Lecha Rav, that this means you have to follow him in everything. Rav Schechter, for example, comes to my town once a month. And he has these open questions. People ask him questions. There's never an assumption that if someone asks him a question, that means every single thing he says he follows. The rabbis of our shuls all ask him questions, and they don't tell the people everything he holds. When I was in Jerusalem once, I asked the Tzitz Eliezer. I had a shiloh. I didn't know what to do, so I was near the Tzitz Eliezer's house. I went to his house, and I asked him a question. I don't think anyone says that then I have to follow every single psak in the Tzitz Eliezer. Rav Lichtenstein himself has written about this, that there's the notion that you can turn to a certain posek who's an expert in one area. We all follow the OU. We eat their food. Does that mean that we all have to follow Rabbi Belsky or Rav Schechter's Pesach? That's another issue we don't have time to get into now, the notion of consistency, what it means. Rav Moshe Feinstein. Doesn't everyone in America rely on Rav Moshe Feinstein for so many matters in shul and everything else? and yet Ramosha Feinstein gave Pesachim very stringent. He said you couldn't use liquid soap on Shabbos. He gave Pesachim about time clocks, and yet the sense of the faithful simply wouldn't accept it. And so there's a lot to say about it. The Erevin, I mentioned Erevin. I lived in Boston. When the Rav was alive, there was no Erevin in Boston. And yet as soon as the Rav died, or he was still alive, actually, he wasn't functioning, they put up an Erev. His followers put up the Erev. So we have examples of when Gedolim even come up with new chumros, Shabbos elevators, things like that. The faithful simply won't accept it. When the OU tried to come up with that, you had to use liquor with hashgacha. We spoke about this already. The people simply wouldn't accept it. So there is a notion of this. It's harder today to have a sense. I'll get to the questions in a minute. It's harder today to have a sense of the faithful. No question about it. Because today we don't have a continuous tradition. And you can always say that people were influenced by the non-Orthodox. In Europe it was easier. In the Hasidic world it was easier. But even in the modern Orthodox world, and even in the non-Hasidic Haredi world, there is, I have no doubt, a sense of the faithful that you get when you study Torah and you're in a community. And if a rabbi says something, even if he has sources, it doesn't seem right. The people just will refuse to accept it. And let's not forget, the Gemara says that if the rabbis, and here we're talking about the Amoraim or the Tanaim, if they make a decree and the people don't accept it, it is not regarded as a valid gezerah. What this means, and we spoke about how Chaim Hirschenson developed this idea, is that at the end of the day, rabbinic decrees really derive their validity from the people. The rabbis come forward and they make a decree, but it's the people who have to accept it. If the people don't accept it, gezerah shel apashta, it's not regarded as valid. There's a very interesting question. What about the first individuals who don't listen to the rabbis? Are they regarded as sinners? I think they are. I think the way you understand this is that when the rabbis make a decree, you have to listen to the rabbis, and the people who don't listen to the rabbis are regarded as sinners. But since all these sinners refuse to listen to the rabbis, that creates a circumstance that the decree, for whatever reason, the decree is no longer binding. And therefore, I also think that probably ex post facto, even the people who violated it might be regarded as no longer sinners. I'm not sure about that. It could be they are. But now what it means is that no one has to listen to the rabbis, even the people who originally did. Obviously, when we speak about the people, the sense of the faithful who decide not to accept this gezeira, we're not talking about the non-religious. They don't count. Even Zachariah Frankel said they don't count. We're talking about a religious community that decides not to listen to what the rabbis say. The gezeira is no longer binding. This ties in, let me just conclude then, there's other concepts we don't have time to go into. I'll read your questions in a minute. There's a notion of minhag mevatel halacha, that a practice of the community can void a halacha. You have Menachem Elon in his book, Mishpat Ivri, states that this only applies in matters of monetary law. That is entirely incorrect. If I ever do publish this article, I have about 75 pages on the notion of acceptance of the Shulchan Aruch. I have a whole section in there on this. There are people who go so far as to say that minhag mevata halacha, even in Torah law. What this means is that if you have a law that appears to be, that's a Torah law, and the people are doing something that seems to be in violation of it, if it's a pious community, you leave them be, and you try to justify it. And that is not the mainstream approach. The mainstream approach says that when it's a Torah law, you have to uproot the custom. But the mainstream approach says that with a rabbinic law, you let them be. But there are those who say minhag mevata halacha, even with regard to a Torah law. And let me explain to you the justification given by Ramosha Chagiz. It's an established principle for us that whenever the halacha is uncertain, go out and see how the community conducts itself. For it is obvious that due to God's love of his people Israel, he will remove a stumbling block from their path, and the entire world will not follow an individual opinion, even if its logic is faulty. Rav Shlomo Laniado, a great posek from Assyria, writes, Kol ma shenahagu Yisrael shechina meskemet imahem. Any time, any practice that the Bnei Yisrael do, God agrees with them. Rav Eliel Ragoler, the Yad Eliel, states, Masha minan muska meitzakal Yisrael hu api ruach hakodesh. If you see the people are doing something, it's a general practice, we assume it's from ruach hakodesh. And I'll just give you one final example. We spoke about this in the past. When we deal with the Dor Raviv, Rav Moshe Shmuel Glasner, we'll deal with it again. Rav Moshe Shmuel Glasner, he's called the Dor Raviv because he's the fourth generation from the Chassam Sofer, the great rabbi of Kloisenberg. He writes in his Sefer, he raises the question about cannibalism. According to the dry halacha, what's the violation of eating human flesh? It's not so clear what it is. Certainly, if it's a non-Jewish body, it's not a Torah prohibition of using. There's no Torah prohibition of using a non-Jewish cadaver. Eating non-kosher food is from the Torah. It's treif from the Torah. So what do you have? What's the situation? Let's say you have dead flesh of a non-Jewish guy just dies. You can eat his body, or you can eat non-kosher. According to the dry halacha, it would appear that you have to eat the human body. And the Dor Raviv says that's impossible. It's impossible to say that faced with such a choice, you should eat human flesh rather than treif. The sense of the faithful, which I think for him means natural law, will not tolerate such a viewpoint. And even though you cannot find me a specific halachic text that says you should eat the flesh, you should eat treif, that is, eat a McDonald's hamburger, instead of eating the human body, the Dor Raviv sees it as obvious, the sense of the faithful, that you cannot say that people should eat a human flesh. Rav Amital develops this idea in one of his recent books. I've heard, I don't know if it's true there, Rav Lichtenstein actually disagrees and thinks that you have to eat the human flesh. This ties in also with the notion of Avera Lishma, as seen in the Yishbitzer and Rav Tzadok, the idea that sometimes the people do things that are wrong. Pinchas did a sin, but he had a sense that this is what he has to do. We'll have to postpone that to another time when we deal with it. But I do just want to read you, and then I'll conclude with this one story about this idea, the sense of the faithful as an individual, of even you might call it Avera Lishma. What's an Avera Lishma? The idea that sometimes Kierkegaard would refer to it as a teleological suspension of the ethical, that sometimes you need to violate the law because it doesn't fit in. Listen to this story from Avram Yehoshua Heschel that he told Samuel Dresner. It appears in Dresner's book, Heschel, Hasidism and Halakha. He says to him, "Sam, I am going to tell you a story I cannot tell anyone else here at the seminary because they," he's referring to Lieberman and Finkelstein, "would not understand me." That is, a Litvak could not understand this story. And if you'll appreciate this story if you've learned some of Tzadok and the Yishbitzer. But my father died when I was 9. At about 14 or 15, I began to study Polish as a window to the wider world. We had no money for lessons, so my family in Vienna provided help. When they could no longer continue, I grew despondent. One Friday afternoon before services, I was sitting on my father's chair in our shtiebel, in a sad mood. Remember, Avraham Yehoshua Heschel was going to become the Rebbe. He was in line to be the Rebbe. It's the Kapitschnitzer dynasty, although I'm not sure if he was the Kapitschnitzer Rebbe himself, but that group. Itchemeyer Levin, a Kutzker Chassid, who usually prayed with us on Shabbos, walked in. Before World War II, you still had Chassidim who referred to themselves as Kutzker Chassidim. He was very close to me, a kind of mentor. I went over to him to discuss my problems, but he dismissed me with the words, "Die Gehenna brennt in mir," hellfire burns in me. That is, he was struggling to purify himself for the oncoming Sabbath, when the gates of hell were said to be closed, by ridding himself of any traces of Gehenna. I returned to my chair and prayed the evening sacrifice with the small group of Hasidim who had arrived. Afterward, Itcha Meir, who observed my dismay, told me that the next morning, before Sabbath services, he would bring me a newly published booklet of the writings of my ancestor, Pinchas of Koritz, a friend of the Baal Shem Tov. By the way, this Itcha Meir, Heschel mentions him in other places. So he published the poems that Heschel published, he dedicated to the Itcha Meir, and he mentions him in the introduction to his Yiddish book on Kutsk. So this Itcha Meir Levin, not to be confused with Itcha Meir Levin, the son-in-law of the Ger Revi, the signer of the Declaration of Independence of the State of Israel. Rav Avraham Yehoshua Heschel was obviously very much influenced by Itcha Meir. The next morning, I was sitting alone in my father's seat before the quorum for prayer had gathered. Itcha Meir arrived and gave me the book he had promised. Eager to examine it, I took it and opened it. To my astonishment, I discovered that it contained money, which, of course, is forbidden to be handled on the Sabbath. As if holding fire, I dropped the book immediately, but Ichimeyer calmed me. Calmed me down by explaining that according to Kutsk, there are times when one may violate a minor law in order to perform a major mitzvah. He had known how important my Polish lessons were to me, and had seen the despair on my face the previous evening on having to discontinue them. For a chassid, no sin is more grievous than despair. Atzvus, despair on Shabbos? To save me from sadness, he had violated the prescription against handling money on the Sabbath. And then Heschel concludes, quote, Hasidism saved me for Judaism. So here we have an amazing story, and there's other amazing stories just like that. Antinomianism, it's called. Hope we'll return to this later on, but I just want to give you an example of how pious people sometimes have a sense, like Kierkegaard spoke about with Abraham going to sacrifice Isaac, that they are called upon, their sense of the faithful calls upon them to move beyond the law. The sense of the faithful we were referring to last week, though, is referring to Klal Yisrael as a whole, when the people as a whole. So let me look at the questions. I have other points, but I'm going to save them for next week. Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, if he says that, then that's fine. I'm just describing this as a sociological phenomenon. I'm not saying whether it's right or wrong or anything, but I'm saying sociologically we have examples of the sense of the faithful. And that's what Itzel Aponovej was talking about. He said that the Gedolim are saying that we can't do this distribution of land because it's Geneva or whatever, and he says, but the people want it, and the people are more important than the Gedolim. If the people say, sociologically, it's certainly true. The Gedolim could say all they want, but if the people don't listen, they don't listen. Rav Itzel Aponovej was not just saying sociologically. He was saying prescriptively that in the machlokas between the people, the holy community of Israel, and the Gedolim, we go by the holy community, this is not in accord with the current notion of Das Torah, which holds that the views of Baal HaBatim are in opposition to Das Torah, and they have to be rejected. But Rav Itzel had a different position. Yes, Rav Kook speaks about it, Jonathan. Good point. We dealt with this when we spoke about Rav Kook, that the people reject halacha, and the rabbis, they scream and they yell, but the people who see clearly see that this is really the sense of the faithful acting with hashgacha pratis, because we do not have a system to get rid of halachot. The only way we can get rid of halachot is by the people not doing them, and then ex post facto, the rabbis have to accept it. That's Rav Kook's theology, correct. Now, a gezeira is more important than a halachic decision. A gezeira is actually establishing something, I think. But it's the same, maybe it's a difference, but it's the same notion. It's the same notion. If the rabbis make a gezeira, if they make a halachic decision, if the people don't listen to it, if a gadol gets up today and says that you can't do X or Y on Shabbos and the people don't listen to it, then the reality is no one listened to Rav Moshe Feinstein when he said you couldn't use liquid soap on Shabbos, so it never became accepted. And if you ask anyone today, they'll say that stock was never accepted. How could it not have been accepted? They're listening to all the other psalchim of Ramosha, especially the Kulas. That's just the way it is. Sociologically, that's the way it is. As I said, you need a whole other class to talk about the propriety of this, whether it's correct. No, I don't think I'm confusing it at all. Yes, you're correct, Dov Weinstein. Well, although, if you remember, Dov, we dealt with this with Rav Chaim Hirschenson. He points out that the Kesef Mishnah says that it shouldn't matter. That even if according to the Kesef Mishnah, even if it's spread and the people stopped observing it, it doesn't matter. But the normal understanding of the Gemara and the Rambam is exactly what you're saying, that it never spread. However, from a sociological perspective, even if it did spread and then the people stopped doing it, the rabbis would have to be being Malamed Zchus. That's just sociologically. But speaking halachically, you are correct according to most interpretations, but not according to the Kesef Mishnah. And if you recall, I know you were on these classes we did Hirschenson, because we dealt with this. That's what Hirschenson wants to know, whether today, since people are not observing these rabbinic laws, could we simply abolish them today? And that's what he deals with. Zach, yeah, I know. We know Rav Avadia. I dealt with Rav Avadia. Antinomianism, N-O-M-I-A-N-I-S-M, the idea that non-observance of the law, that you can find spiritual satisfaction in opposition to the law. That's always a problem. The Hasidim have antinomian tendencies, not so much anymore. We've calmed them down. But I don't know. The only one that still remains, I think, is their davening times. They don't accept the laws of when you have to daven. Not all the Hasidim, but some of the Hasidim. That's an example of antinomianism, the notion that the law doesn't apply to them. It applies maybe to other people, but they are above the law. In the days of the Rishonim, you had this issue of antinomianism. There was great fear by the Rashba and others that some of these philosophers were arguing that the law doesn't apply to them because they know the reasons for the law. And the Rambam deals with this. And the classic example is Shlomo HaMelech. Shlomo HaMelech had an antinomian perspective. He thought that he understood the reasons why you couldn't marry many women and why you couldn't have many horses, because so he wouldn't be led to idolatry, so someone isn't led to idolatry, and things of that nature. And Shlomo HaMelech said, since I know the reason, therefore I don't need to follow the law. That's antinomianism. And the whole point that the Rambam mentions is that the reason we see his error, that he did end up worshiping idols, and that's what the Rambam brings an example against this conception, this antinomian conception, that that if you know the reasons for the law, therefore the laws don't apply to you, they apply to the masses. But in Hasidus, you have antinomian tendencies, or Tzadok and the Ishvitzer and others, they speak about the individual, they speak about individuals who have a sense, a special sense of the will of God. And sometimes the will of God could be in opposition to the halakha. So what do you do when the will of God is in opposition to the halakha? And Kierkegaard spoke, the will of God was that Abraham should sacrifice Isaac, but obviously you can't murder. And Rav Tzadok and Yishvitzer, what do you do when the will of God, well, that was Pinchas' issue. The will of God was to kill Zimri, and yet the halakha is you couldn't kill Zimri. And if you asked a question, the answer would be you can't. And yet Pinchas goes ahead and does it anyway, and ex post facto it's regarded as a good thing. Even though it is in violation of halakha, because for certain individuals, they have a sense. They feel the will of God, and this is this is what they call avera lishma. And the thing about Hasidus is it's not just for individuals, for them. The whole community can violate certain halakhot, like davening times. If you're praying with the Rebbe. If you're with the Rebbe. When you're by yourself, no. Let me just see quickly some more questions. I don't know what you mean, Bill. It's Gezeres Shel Pashta, but the question is, what does that mean? Does that mean that at the beginning only, which seems to be Pshat, but if you look in the Kesem Mishnah, Kesem Mishnah seems to think it shouldn't make a difference, that if the Gezeres spread and then people stopped following it, of course the answer would be it would have to be people who are pious who stopped following it, not the non-observant. The Reform don't count. The Conservative don't count. We're talking about regular, pious communities who stopped following it for whatever reason. That is the Kesem Mishnah's position. I think it has a lot to do with sense of the faithful, but we'll have to pick it up next week. Email me your comments, and I'll bring them up next week. And okay, let me look quickly. I know what you're saying, Bill. You're saying that to avoid it, you must have a... It says to void a gezerah, you must have a greater basin. It's a good point. I'll look again at the Kesem Mishnah. That's a good point. What's the Kesem Mishnah mean then? If to void it, you need a greater basin. I think what the Kesem Mishnah would mean, I just have to look at it again, is the Rambam is speaking about if the basin wants to avoid it. It has nothing to do with the people. Then you need a greater basin. Gadol b'chachma b'minyan. But if the people themselves stop following it, then it has nothing to do with Basin. Basin just comes to be the rubber stamp. That's what the Kesem Mishnah is referring to then, that if the people stop, it's a separate issue. Okay, let us go on. I have other things, but we've already spent a half hour. I'll show you this next week. I think this will really blow you away, but we'll deal with that next week. Okay, we now have turned to Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Chazan. Believe me, everyone, I could spend a whole hour on every one of these points, because not only are they fascinating, I'm sure many of you listening realize they can be brought in many different directions, including very dangerous directions. It's not an accident that the Kutzker and the Ishvitzer and others were viewed with a lot of suspicion, because certain ideas could be very problematic. Shlomo Carlebach himself was led into antinomianism. He was asked about why he hugs women and all this, and his answer was very much in line with what I mentioned, that he felt that this is what he needed to do to fulfill his mission from God, and the fact that the halacha said otherwise, okay. We now turn to Italy. Italy was a great center for rabbinic scholarship for many centuries. In medieval times, some of the most important figures were in Italy. The earliest figures, the Aruch, comes from Italy, and many, many Gedolim in Italy. You move into the Renaissance, important Gedolim, even post-Renaissance, the Ramchal, etc. We could spend numerous classes on important Italian figures. Yet in the 19th century, things begin to change. The last native Italian, who's a great halakhic authority, his name is Rabbi Shmuel HaKohen of Munna. None of us would name our kids Yishmol today, although Yishmol was obviously an important name. One of the greatest Tanaim is named Yishmol. This goes back to the Talmudic idea that Ishmael repented. Still, it never became a popular name, but there were a couple well-known rabbis who were named Yishmol. I think if we didn't have the Arab-Israeli dispute, we might still be naming our kids Yishmol. And Rabbi Shmuel HaKohen, his name, I don't know if any of you have heard of him, he authored the responsa volumes Zera Emet. When I mentioned him to my class at Yeshiva Chol Vetorah, and I said he's a very important postseik, I got stares, denials, and I told him on the spot, they had this Bar-Ilan computer, one of the students had a Bar-Ilan responsa thing in his computer, I told him to take out Rav Avadi Yosef's Chuvot, Yavia Omer, and Yechavadot, and any of you can do this experiment, and plug in Igrot Moshe, and plug in Zera Emet, and you will see that Rav Avadi Yosef quotes the Zera Emet many more times than the Igrot Moshe, showing that he is a more important posek for Rav Avadia than Rav Moshe Feinstein. And he was a very important posek. He was also on the Sanhedrin of Napoleon. But he is the last of the important Italian poskim. In the 19th century, you have important figures. You have Shadal, Shmuel Dovetzato, you have Reggio. But these are not rabbis. These are not halachists. These are thinkers. These are scholars, etc. Yes, Ari, you remember my post from the Sfarim blog. The Zera Emet has many interesting and wonderful psukim and tshuvot. And, of course, maybe due to my putting it up there, he's remembered for the one outrageous psuk that if there's a kid in your community who's a mamzer, you should tattoo on his forehead this information that he's a mamzer. And if you're going to say, well, tattooing, isn't that usser? Yeah, it's usually usser to tattoo. But if it's a choice between tattooing someone and taking a chance that he's going to end up in a different community and intermarry with non-mamzerim, we tattoo the person. And you can have a non-Jew do the tattooing. I don't know, Ari. I hope you know some other tshuvot of the Zera Emet, because it's not fair to judge him by that response, which, incidentally, Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin, in his B'nei Vanim, deals with this response and really rejects it. This became a famous response only because not many people read the Zera Emet inside, if you're an Ashkenazi, but the Darche Tshuva of Rav Shapiro, the Munkacher Rav's father. It's a classic text on Halachas of Yoredeya, the Darche Tshuva. He quotes, in dealing with the Halachas of Tattoo, he quotes this Tshuva Zera Emet. So all the Ashkenazic poskim, they all use the Darche Tshuva. The typical Ashkenazi poseg knew nothing about the Zera Emet, just this Tshuva. And it's a long Tshuva, actually. You can find it now on HebrewBooks.org. There was, however, although I say that you have all these Italian figures who are fascinating but not remembered as great post-Kohanim, important people. We will deal with Shadal and Reggio in future classes, if God willing. There was one post-Kohanim of lasting significance, not just a post-Kohanim, more than a post-Kohanim, and that is Rav Yisrael Moshe Chazan of Rome. Now, sometimes his name appears as Moshe Yisrael Chazan. He signs it that way also, sometimes. I don't know why. 90% of the time, he signs it Yisrael Moshe Chazan. Occasionally, he'll sign it Moshe Yisrael Chazan. And he becomes known by a nickname. Here it is. I'm going to pull it up here for you. Oops. Let me get this again. Hold on. See how he signs his name? It's getting smaller. I don't know who's making it smaller. Let me go back here. You can see. You can see it at least. He signs his name Mashiach. Oh, there we go again. Someone's helping me out here. Okay. Whoever's helping me out, thank you. He signs his name sometimes, Moshe Yisrael Chazan, so he started signing his name with the abbreviation Mashiach. I don't know why. He certainly didn't think he was a Mashiach. But in the rabbinic literature following him, he often is referred to by the acronym Katav HaMashiach, or something like that, or Katav Mashiach, Memshin Yud Squiggly Mark Chet. And if you don't know the literature, if you're not familiar with the way Sfardim referred to their Gedolim, you won't know what it's talking about. But now I just told you this, you know that it refers to Yisrael Moshe Chazan. There are, in general, in the Sephardic world, there are all sorts of acronyms and ways of referring to people. For example, the Ben Ishchai, he's known as Rav Yosef Chaim. That's his name, is Rav Yosef Chaim. In Iraq, they didn't seem to have last names. The last names are first names. So you have Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, Rav Avad Yosef. So you have Rav Yosef Chaim. But Rav Yosef Chaim, it's Reish Yud Squili Marchet. So Reyach, so smell. So in the Sephardic halachic literature, they refer to, as the Reyach HaTov claims, they refer to Rav Yosef Chaim as Reyach HaTov. If you're an Ashkenazi and you're reading this book and you're saying, you know, as Reyach HaTov pointed out, you won't know who's Reyach HaTov. But, you know, in the Sephardic world, you know that Reyach stands for Rav Yosef Chaim, and they have all sorts of these acronyms, and Yisrael Moshe Chazan is known as Mashiach. Ah, Yamach, as in Yamach Shemel. Maybe that's a good point, David Eisen. You don't want to say Yamach, so then he becomes, to name himself Mashiach is a little bit strange, but that's how he became known. And in the Sephardic world, you have many such examples of these acronyms. The Chazan family, Yisrael Moshe Chazan, is an important family. I'm a Sephardic family. I assume there were Chazanim in the family. That's where they got the name. Many Torah scholars, as well as a few Rishon Lezions, that is, chief rabbis of Israel. The grandfather of Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Chazan is the author of the work Chikrei Lev, which is one of the classic halachic texts of the late 18th century. Now, Jose Faur, great scholar Jose Faur, who I was privileged to meet this summer, he comes to deal every summer, I actually met him, I went down to see him the Sunday after the scandal broke in deal. The scandal broke, I think, on Monday. I was there the following Sunday, and it was quite interesting hearing from the inside. He wrote an entire book on Yisrael Moshe Chazan. In fact, when I was in deal, he showed me unpublished manuscripts of Yisrael Moshe Chazan. And in the introduction to this book, he explains why he wrote it. Now, I have a copy of this book, but I have it in this volume. Take a look at this. I have a big, thick volume called Kitvei Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Chazan. Look how thick it is. I think it's probably about 2,000 pages. A friend of mine, years ago, he was interested in Yisrael Moshe Chazan, so he put together all the writings of Yisrael Moshe Chazan in this massive volume, and he bound it himself. He only made about 50 copies, and he gave me one. And he asked Faur, could he include his biography? And he did. So that's how I have a copy of it. Now, in the introduction, he explains what led him to write this book. We're going to talk about a number of the books that are in here, so why don't you wait? He also has some manuscripts in here, and sermons that Yisrael Moshe Chazan gave when he was in London, in Italy, sermons when he was in Italy, with the Italian translation, all sorts of very, very rare materials. But I'll tell you about some of it. Faur explains in the introduction what led him to write a book about Yisrael Moshe Chazan. This, I think, was Faur's first real piece of writing about more recent Sephardic authorities. Until then, he had written about classical stuff, he had written about Targum, about the Rambam, other things. He states, most people, even great Torah scholars, are not aware of the religious and cultural traditions of the Sephardim. When we dealt with Rav Uziel, we spoke about this, and with others. There's a whole tradition there. And what is Falwar speaking about? He's speaking about their humanism, their involvement with general culture, with Jewish philosophy, with Bible studies, with grammar, with poetry. Falwar explained to me what it was like in Argentina, the education he got. This is an education, by the way. One of the Ashkenazim, right, who came to Amsterdam in the 1700s, left a record of what he saw there in the Sephardic Talmud Torahs. If you want to know where the Sephardim get their melitza, their way of writing, how they all seem to know Tanakh baal peh, and were by heart, and were therefore able to write in a way that only it's unusual for Ashkenazim to write, he describes how the Talmud Torah in Amsterdam, the Sephardic Talmud Torah, how they would start with Tanakh and work their way up slowly until you got the Talmud. It's a completely different curriculum. It's a curriculum that studied grammar, that studied Yehuda HaLevi, that studied the Mor Nevuchim, a very different curriculum than what we're used to. Poetry. Who reads poetry? And yet there was a Sparta curriculum that taught Yehuda HaLevi, Ibn Ezra, Ibn Gavirol, they wrote Hebrew poetry. And therefore you have to read their Hebrew poetry. So it's a different curriculum. I don't think we can create that curriculum today. We're just trying to get people to understand Hebrew. But if you imagine starting at age 4 or 5, when you're brought up, the only one who I think tries to do it is Rav Mazuz and B'nai Brak. They learn the old script. Most people today can't read the old Sephardic script. They learn the Sephardic, they learn grammar. They learn, biblical exegesis, so the classical approaches. At least he teaches poetry. He teaches the people that they should study this stuff. How many of them do it, I don't know. But at least in that yeshiva, this is regarded as important. Thank you very much. And Fa'ur is alluding to the triumph of the Ashkenazi way of life in the Sephardic world. If you go to the Sephardic world, you don't have this. If you go to Kisei Rachim and B'nai Brak, okay, so there you have still some of the Sephardic, the old Sephardic approach. Is there any place in America where the Sephardic approach exists, where it survives? You had old Chachamim from the Syrian community, or Matzu Babadi and others, but it doesn't exist anywhere else. There's this guy, David Shasha. I think that's how I pronounce his name. You might have seen some of his emails. He published a little book in which that's his crusade. We spoke about this guy's crusade, the son of the Chazan from the Breuer's community, who publishes a little book attacking the community in Washington Heights. This guy likes to attack the Syrian community. He goes so far as to say that the rabbis of our community today, they couldn't even tell you where the Library of Congress is. And his whole point is comparing what the old Sephardic approach was when he was growing up with the Ashkenazic Sephardic approach today, and how terrible it is. And there's a lot of truth to what he's saying, that this is not the traditional Sephardic approach. But this is what Fatwar writes. Quote, and here he's explaining the Sephardic approach that we're going to see in Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Chazan that you saw for hundreds of years. Not all Sephardim held to this. No question about it. In Aleppo, for example, you had real Kanaim in Aleppo. But this was an important approach found throughout much of the Sephardic world. This is Fowler. Quote, Judaism is not a static ideal to be maintained by erecting walls that would prevent any meaningful interaction with the general cultural environment. There is perennial need for interpretation and adaptation of the eternal values of Israel in order to meet the specific conditions of every historical situation. It is the task of the Jewish sage, in particular, to interpret the key cultural symbols of his own times in light of this mental language, on the one hand, and the constitutive values of Israel, on the other. Basically, what Hirsch would call Torah im Derech Eretz. Yes, Benny Brown does have an article on radical Sephardim, and I believe he makes a mistake, and I believe that Svi Zohar is correct on this. First of all, one of the so-called radical Sephardim he talks about is the Saba Kadisha, and yet he was unaware that the famous Saba Kadisha, Al-Fandari, he came out against the opponents of Rav Kook and wanted to put them in Chayrim. There's a letter he wrote to Rav Charlap about this, but the people he brings are such minor, insignificant people. These are not mainstream people. There's even an Eda Charedit of Sephardim, so of course you have some Sephardim Kanaim, but you never had extremism in the Sephardic world like you had in the Ashkenazic world. It is true, as I said, that in Aleppo you did have some kanai. For example, they burnt Ben Amozig's commentary there, even though it was accepted in all sorts of other places. But even in Aleppo, you still had a tradition that was more open-minded than you would have in later years. Yeah, the Gra, we also say about the Gra Maharal Chinuch is very similar, but it was never accepted. So who is Rabbi Shlomo Chazan? Well, he's born in Smyrna, Turkey, today, the Turkish Empire, today known as Izmir, in 1808. As a child, he comes to Jerusalem, where his grandfather, Rav Yosef Rafael Chazan, was Rishon LeZion. In 1842, he's not that old, 34 years old, he's appointed to the Basin of Jerusalem. And the following year, he leaves the land of Israel, not to return till 1862. 20 years later, just before his death. We do not know why he left. Although Fa'ur cites passages from Chazan's writings which imply that he did it because of certain opposition he faced in Jerusalem. So we see that there was, even in Jerusalem, this idea that you couldn't study secular writings. It seems that the Abbas and Rav Yaakov Finzi opposed his study of philosophy. Not all Sephardim were enlightened in the sense that we're using it now, but Fa'ur is correct that there was a tradition of Sephardic enlightenment. You did not have such a tradition in the Ashkenazic world after medieval times. What you had were individual rabbis, a rabbi here, a rabbi there. In Italy, you had a tradition. In Europe, the rest of Europe, you didn't have it. You had, like I said, a rabbi here, a rabbi there, but there was no tradition. And these were unique figures, unusual figures, who broke with the model. But in the Sephardic world, you still had a strong tradition of Sephardic enlightenment, and you had opponents to it, obviously, but you had this tradition. Chazan leaves the land of Israel, and he journeys to various communities. Fa'ur compares him to the Chida, Rav Chaim Joseph David Azulai, who also, in order to raise money for the land of Israel, he leaves, he travels all over Italy and France, he has a wonderful diary, Magal Tov, which was translated to English. I don't know if it's a complete translation. I know that certain sections were taken out for, like, reasons of censorship, or so I was told. I haven't investigated it myself, but I don't know if it's a complete diary. But it's a fascinating work, important book. It's translated to other languages also. It gives you a glimpse of Jewish life at the time. And the Chida didn't just travel. He had an enormous impact on Jewish communities everywhere he went. In fact, until Rav Avadi Yosef, the only figure known as Maran after the Shulchan Aruch was the Chida. We spoke about how Rav Yitzchak Nissim brought his bones to the land of Israel. And if you go on Har HaMenuchos, you'll see he has a whole he has a whole thing out of this little, you go underneath, this whole thing closed, a mausoleum, I guess you call it. And the people go there in Davin. That's the famous Chida. And he does the same thing, Fa'ur. Although he's not really, I don't know how much he's raising money. He did raise some money, if I'm not mistaken, if I recall correctly. But that wasn't his real reason. He goes to Tunisia. Then he goes to Algeria, Morocco, and he comes to London around 1845. Chida was a great person, a great collector of manuscripts, etc. as well. What was going on in London in 1845? Well, there was a lot of reformist sentiment taking place in London in 1845, a whole proto-reform movement. And to make matters even more interesting, we're talking Sephardim, Sephardic Reform Jews, or proto-reform Jews. And it was a great dispute that was tearing apart the Sephardic community of London. And many people have written on it. It's been subject to a great deal of discussion. I wrote a little article about it also, because some of the people there turned to Reggio in Italy, asking him his opinion on this. In fact, reform in England first came from the Sephardim, not from the Ashkenazim. Let me just give you a brief summary, and then we'll see what Yisrael Moshe Chazan's role in this. You had in the Sephardic community of London, going back to 1663, when they first returned to England, they had been expelled from England, and then they're let back in. They have regulations. These regulations, they're called the Askamot. The first Askamot forbade, under penalty of Cherem, the establishment of separate Sephardic synagogues without the permission of the leaders of the community. And not only that, even the assembly of 10 men for worship. That is, you could not have a little minion in your house on Shabbos morning, or else you would be put under cheirim. I'd like to see any rabbi in America try this to stop the breakaway. She'll say that anyone, but we can't, obviously, in America. We're all about autonomy. But this was the practice, this was the rule in the Sparta community of London, and also was the rule in many other communities, not just Sparta communities. But this was in the original charter, as it were, of the rules of the community of London. I'm wondering if you looked at the charter of the Spanish and Portuguese in New York, you might see the same thing. And if you violated this, you were automatically placed under the ban. You didn't even need the rabbis to get together, apparently. It says, at least the text says, you're automatically placed under the ban, although there presumably was some sort of ceremony to confirm it. In the 1830s, the Sparta community began expanding to the western part of London, and they were no longer in walking distance of the main Sephardic shul, the Bevis Marks Synagogue. Yeah, what you say, Chaim Lander, is correct. It was a big deal, and the community wanted to shut him down. I think they probably could have, but they didn't want to make an issue out of it. But he did not have permission to open his own minyan. The Sephardic shul was the Bevis Marks Synagogue. So a lot of people wanted a natural thing. We see it in our own communities all the time. A branch synagogue. Not an independent synagogue, but a branch synagogue. In addition to being closer and thus more convenient, that's one thing they wanted, but they also wanted to introduce some variations in the service. For example, beginning later in the winter. I don't recall what time they started, but there are shuls in London at this time. It might even be Bevis Marks, but there are other shuls that would start Shabbos morning 6 a.m., which is obviously shocking. Whenever I see shuls that start 6 or 6:30 a.m., I always assume that the people are going to work afterwards. What other possible reason could there be? They wanted English sermons. They also wanted a choir. There was obviously some halachic problems with the proposals, not necessarily all the ones we mentioned. But they did, for example, want to stop calling people up for aliyahs. They thought that was not dignified. So instead, you give people a little piece of paper or something, or where it says, let's say, third aliyah. So you say, Yamod Shlishi. And the third aliyah comes up. The idea that you call people up, I don't know why they had such a problem with it. In Germany also, they wanted to get rid of this. I never could figure out what's the big deal. You call someone by his name, you call him up the number. I don't see how that disturbs the synagogue. Now, if you want to get rid of the Mishaberos afterwards, that makes sense. But just to call people up by their name, but that's what they wanted to do. Well, obviously, they didn't have to help out with the kids in those days because the women didn't go to shul. The women all stayed home. This idea of women going to shul is a modern thing. That's why you'll have early minyanim. Women helping out with the shul, men helping out. Do you know that you have Haredi communities today where the men are the main helpers? The women are going out to work, and the men are the ones who are helping out and everything. It's a complete reversal of everything traditional. Jews are supposed to be in line with the traditional family values, the woman at home, the man working. There's been a complete reversal of values in some parts of the Haredi world, and now they even justify it, that the woman gets fulfillment, etc., etc. I don't know. As far as I know, there's a pasuk in the beginning of Bereishis that says that with the sweat of his brow, the man will bring home goes out and work. I don't see how you can argue with an explicit pasuk in the Torah that says that it's a man's job to go out and work. I'm not talking about temporarily. Obviously, a man could temporarily be in graduate school or in kollel, but the idea that as a way of life, the Haredi world is going to adopt a radical feminist viewpoint that a woman should be out and the man should be, that there's no difference, that the idea that a woman has some role in the house, that's, passé and quaint. Hasn't traditional Judaism always thought that, has always put value on the fact that a woman's value is in the home, etc.? So I don't know. It's quite live in an olam hafuch, as they say, a roundabout world, a turned upside down world. The reformists, let me just speak for two more minutes. The reformist sentiments of this group, however, were seen most clearly when they called for and then carried out, they established a community and carried out the abolishment of the second day of Yom Tov. They took this step before the German reformers. this was always an issue, the second day of Yom Tov, because it affected people's parnassa to a great extent. If you look in Meir Benayahu, he has a whole book on the topic, and there was a lot of agitation to get rid of the second day of Yom Tov. I know in America people have agitation. They don't like it. They don't understand it. The best explanation you can give today, I think, is that it's a punishment for all of us who are living in the diaspora, and that way it seems to make a lot of sense, from my perspective at least. Although the Munkacher, he attached a certain holiness to it. When he went to visit the land of Israel, he made sure to leave by Shavuos so that he could observe the second day of Yom Tov, because he had an idea that there was some sort of extra value in observing it. But the standard view is, of course, is just that this is the Gezeira. When you're in the land of Israel, you observe one day. Now it's become actually a Zionist Haredi dispute. When I was in Israel years ago, it wasn't. Any good religious Zionists, when they go for Pesach, to go to Israel for Pesach, of course, they'll only observe one day, and the Haredi will only observe 2 days, even if they're living there a couple of years. And it's really very foolish, this whole thing, because it has nothing to do with religious Zionism or not. These are halachic issues, and these were debated by important figures, the Chacham Tzvi, Rav Yaakov Emden, and others, but it's like so many things else, it's come into politics. I see it's already reached 10 o'clock here, so we'll stop here. We'll continue, obviously, next class, and probably the class after, with this person who I think you'll agree, when all is said and done, one of the most fascinating figures of 19th century rabbinic literature, Rav Yisrael Moshe Chazan. So let me just stop here. If there's questions or comments, we'll stay on for another 10 minutes, 15 minutes or so. Does it mean selling the Aliyot, perhaps? I know that in Germany they got rid of selling all the Aliyos. That they got rid of too. That was a big deal. But there is a separate issue here where they talk about calling up people by number. Maybe you're right. Maybe it's tied in, but they separate it. That was another thing. All these shuls would sell the Aliyos and everything else, and they got rid of that. But they had a problem also with the names. That's how it's portrayed in the sources. So I don't know what to make of it. Do you know that the first Reform communities in Germany, they didn't read the Torah with the Trupp? They just read it? They thought that was unidentified also. Now, I mean, that's striking me as very boring and very difficult to just sit and read the whole Parsha. Just read it, not with any tune. But they thought that that was not dignified. Things that we can't appreciate today, in a different culture, these are important values for whatever reason. Yes, Ethan, they are very feminist. The Haredi world has become very feminist. They want all the women out there working. Let me just tell you a joke. I don't know if it's true, but the story has it that this Rav comes to the Space Yaakov, and of course he has to speak to the women about how it's so important they marry someone who the rest of his life he's going to spend in Kolel, and they have to support him, etc. And this bright girl raises her hand and says, Rebbe, I have a question. I don't understand that. I understand that because of the sin of Eve, that we were given the punishment, the curse, that we have to give birth in pain. But why are you also giving us Adam's curse? His curse was that he has to work hard, and you're giving us both the curses. The Hasidim never bought into this. From the Hasidic perspective, the idea of women leaving the home is a tznius issue, and it's also not in line with traditional values. This became really a litvisha perspective, not so much in America, because in America most people do go out and work eventually, but in Israel you have a difference. You can really stay in Kolel forever, and you're right, it's creation of a feminist. What would you do with all of Hirsch's wonderful writings about how the woman is the mainstay of the home, and she finds herself in the home while the man goes out and has to work out in the difficult job and deal with all the challenges of the outside, while the woman, we protect our women and keep them in the home, etc., etc. I guess you'd have to chuckle that. Sheshi Samim Tavod is I don't get it. Lashon Nieva? I don't know what that means. But if you want to hear another joke, what?
Lashon
Nekeva. Oh, Nekeva. Okay, yeah. Well, the other joke is they got very angry when someone came out with a commentary in the Book of Eov. He didn't write Eov in transliteration. He wrote Job. And Job means job, so it's a real problem. Look, I don't want to make light of the issue. It's an important issue, and it needs to be discussed. And obviously, this is an issue that's going to reach a breaking point in Israel someday. But the idea that the role of a man is simply to learn all day, all men, not the Yechideh school, and not the individual exceptional ones, that in itself would be an interesting to say that all men have to learn. But the idea that a woman's job is to support a man, not just 1 year or 2 years, lots of women support their husbands in medical school, but as a lifestyle choice, the job that Jewish women are now, especially from the most sneeze part of our community, are supposed to go out and work and support their husbands, which is a complete reversal of all the values that we're taught and the whole notion why women don't have to do certain things and men have to do certain things. That'll have important implications on the future of that community, so it remains to be seen. Let's see, a few more questions. The letter of Saba Kedisha Rav Kook. Saba Kedisha writes a letter to Rav Harlap. Rav Harlap writes to him about all these people who are attacking Rav Kook, and the Saba Kedisha writes, and he didn't agree with Rav Kook's ideology, I can send you a copy of the letter, that these people have to not only be disciplined, we have to put monetary punishments upon them to keep them in line. People need to see this letter because they think that the Saba Kedisha is some crazy fanatic. He was a bit extreme, but he had respect for all Gedol Yisrael and stood up against the people who came out against Rav Kook. By the way, Betzal Naor refers to this in his translation of Oroth in one of the notes, but I have a copy of it. I've had it for years. Okay, that's true. That would be nice and good. Okay, I see a lot of jokes. We have a lot of comedians on the line today. It is a serious issue, so I don't want to make light of it, and I certainly don't want to knock the idea of people devoting themselves intensively to Torah study. But that's not what we're referring to here. I think we're referring to the idea that you change the structure of the Jewish community, so now it is the woman who is the breadwinner. Maybe there's nothing wrong with it. If you're a modern person, but the thing is, these communities we're talking about are very traditional communities, and it always was about traditional roles. And you can't have the woman as the breadwinner, and then you've turned upside down. It's no longer a traditional community. That's going to have all sorts of implications, and it's going to affect the self-image of women. It's going to affect marriage issues, marriage prospects. Women are going to have to become educated. They're going to have to improve in their careers. And then you're going to have a culture gap between them and their husbands. There's no way it can make for happy relationships. And the Gedolim in Israel recognize that. That's why they said the women couldn't get any advanced degrees. But, of course, how can you get a decent living if you don't get any advanced degrees? You're supposed to be the breadwinner, and yet you can't get an advanced degree. We'll see how this all plays out. Okay, for those who don't know, let me just say, for the few who are still on, the 31, Ethan Eisenberg gets a big yasher koach. We mentioned in past numerous times his masterpiece on the Rav. He is the documentary filmmaker who put together the movie about the Rav, which I'm sure you've all seen. It's one of these pieces of work that it's bigger than any individual. They're going to be watching this long after we're gone, but he did an incredible job, and I don't know if anyone else, certainly I'll be happy if a few thousand people have read anything I've done, and Ethan can, we're probably into the hundreds of thousands who've now seen this video, so he gets a big yasher koach. Any other comments or questions? Okay, so if anyone else doesn't have anything, I'll stay on for one more minute. We have lots of new people, which is exciting. Very good. I'll stay on for about one more minute if anyone wants to pop over a question. Thank you. Okay. Well, if anyone wants to send me something, just email it to me. I'll get to it. I still have lots of things to get to from previous classes. Good night, everyone.